During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale. Right.
It's almost Election Day, Central Ohio, and your voice matters. On Tuesday, November 4th, COTA is making it easier to get to the polls with free rides all day long on all services. No fare, no hassle. Just hop on board on Tuesday, November 4th for an easy way to cast your vote. Whether you're taking the bus, COTA Mainstream, or COTA Plus, your ride is on us. Let's roll to the polls together. Plan your trip on the transit app or at coda.com.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Her Lotus Year, China, the Roaring Twenties, and the Making of Wallace Simpson is a new book by Paul French, which documents the revealing history of legendary Wallace Simpson's controversial and formative year in China in the 1920s. I'm delighted to say that Paul French joins me live on the line now to discuss this period of Wallace Simpson's life I wasn't aware of. Paul, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining me this morning. Now, you based yourself in China, if I believe correctly, for several years, so you have knowledge of the area. And how did this story come across your radar, as it were?
Well, back in the 1980s, I was a language student in Shanghai. And then in the 90s, I went back there and I lived in Shanghai for 20 years and I still visit China regularly. So I'm a kind of a China guy. I'm not a royal guy, if you see what I mean. And most of the books about Wallace Simpson have been written by royal specialists for whom Chinese history and politics is confusing, to say the least, as it is to most of us. And the time I was living in Shanghai, visitors would always mention the various rumors about Wallace Simpson's time in China that had been passed around in the 1930s at the time of the abdication crisis and have kind of lingered around her. Some of them are sort of, you know, quite sexual. Others of them intimate that she was involved with drug running, with gambling gangs, things like that. And none of them struck me as a China person as particularly true. So I kind of was curious as to what she actually did get up to, because she's 28 years old when she's in China. So this is a Wallace Simpson 12, 13 years before she meets the Prince of Wales in London. So it's a very different person.
Because, I mean, again, most of us Brits will know Wallace Simpson as, you know, the American divorcee, abdication, etc. And she seems to have sprung fully formed in that role, at the age of, you know, late 30s, early 40s. But obviously there is a life before that. What's she actually doing in China? I mean, she's not gone to Rhode Island and taken the wrong turn, for goodness sake. So how did she end up in Shanghai of all places?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is she had never given China, Shanghai, Beijing a thought in her life. But her first husband, because she was twice divorced, her first husband was an American naval officer who was posted to Hong Kong. Their marriage was on the rocks. He was a drinker, but she decided to follow him and restart her life. And she went initially to Hong Kong, but unfortunately, he started drinking again. He beat her up. And I think when we think of Wallace Simpson, we don't really think of a woman who was badly abused and had to run away from her marriage. And she believed if she could get to Shanghai, which of course at that time was famously this kind of international city where you didn't need passports and all that sort of thing, she thought that she could get a divorce there. So she ran away from Hong Kong and she got a boat up to Shanghai. She couldn't get a divorce there, but she decided she quite liked the freedom. This is 1924, remember? She stayed there for a while and then moved on and ended up in Beijing. And although she's often associated with Shanghai because Shanghai has that racy, sexy reputation that we all sort of think about, she actually spent most of her time in Beijing and really fell in love instantly with the kind of ancient capital, a much slower paced, more intrinsically Chinese city than Shanghai.
I suppose the thing is, though, when we're looking at history from the 30s backwards, it fits in with the narrative that somebody like Wallis Simpson is going to be seen as this twice divorced woman who spent her time in Shanghai. And Shanghai is mentioned in the same breath as Berlin in the 20s, and it's that whole louche thing. And rather than somebody who goes and falls in love with another culture, because she just, you know, and it would suit the, again, the narrative of those trying to portray her as this sort of, this, shall we say, bohemian, slightly sort of shady female that she's living in Shanghai, which, you know, to your average person who's not living in the Jazz Age, but perhaps is living in a, you know, in Slough or something, it's all the things that are wrong with the world.
Well, very much. And remember, you know, being twice divorced and an American wasn't quite enough to undermine the relationship with the man who had become Prince of Wales, King Edward VIII, by that point. They needed something else. And what the government of the day with the Church of England and some of the establishment did was they sort of cooked up, sexed up this document that sort of talked about her time in China. And I think that fed into, remember, this is 1936, so it's feeding into a kind of yellow peril that's going on in Britain at the time and America, which is, you know, the Fu Manchu movies, things like that. The idea that a white woman on her own in the East, in China, has somehow lost her moral compass. There must be something wrong with you. At the same time, of course, everyone in Europe was obsessed with Chinese things, Chinese style, Chinese aesthetics. But there was this kind of Sinophobia, this yellow peralism. And so, you know, the idea was to try and damn her once again in the eyes of, well, the royal family, the establishment, and particularly, of course, the king, in the hope that he would give her up. The ordinary working class people of Britain, by the way, didn't know anything about this. It was never reported in the papers. It was a whispering campaign in kind of Mayfair and country estates. And if you ask the ordinary person on the street, they thought that, you know, us working class people are quite sentimental, aren't we? We just thought, well, if he loves her, he should marry her. And, you know, who really cares? But it really did damn her in the eyes of that. It tried to undermine her. But of course, It wasn't ultimately successful, because he did abdicate, he did marry her, and they lived in exile to ripe old ages.
Indeed. Interesting enough, because again, most of us will know this period of Chinese history from The Last Emperor. Simple as. Yeah, basically, they've seen that thing, and again, it's people falling off their chaise lounges, off their nuts on opium. But it's a really interesting period, because you have Japan coming to the fore, and China is embroiled in the Civil War, and obviously America is trying to impose itself as in the region as well. We've had the fallout from the Russia-Sino War from only 20 years before as well, which, so Japan is a major naval power. China is huge, but obviously it is falling apart with civil strife. So for a single attractive American woman in Beijing, or Peking, whatever you want to call it at that time, there must have been the opportunity to perhaps report back. I mean, was there any sort of espionage thing? Because she's well-connected.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And your knowledge of Chinese history is better than about 98% of people's. I mean, a lot of my work is trying to kind of slip in a Chinese history lesson through attracting you in through another way. It was an absolute 1924 to 1925, the year she spent there, was absolutely mad. It's a pivotal year for China. You're quite right. Right at the start of it, Puyi, the last emperor, is expelled from the Forbidden City into the hands of the Japanese. The Japanese are looking to take over northern China. You know, there are two governments in China, one in the south under Dr. Sun Yat-sen, a Republican government, another one, a revolving series of governments in Beijing by warlords. And these are people who have private armies and control, or that China will just explode. And this year is one of the wettest years on record, destroying crops. There's typhoid outbreaks, there's cholera outbreaks. I mean, there's bandits running wild across the place. There's the biggest strikes we've ever seen in Hong Kong and in Guangzhou as well. And she's in the middle of all of this. And I think when you look at what she goes to Shanghai, finds out she can't get a divorce. She does a bit of shopping. She enjoys the horse racing. But then what does she do? She doesn't get on a boat to America. And there's about two ocean liners to America every week from Shanghai at that point. She decides to go to Tianjin, first of all, which is just full of cholera. People are dropping dead on the streets of typhoid and cholera. And then she goes 70 miles inland to Beijing. And my contention is, and if you read the book, I think, you know, the argument sort of comes out, is that because of the chaos at the time, the railways weren't working properly. The telegraph system wasn't working properly. America, particularly its embassies and consulates and naval intelligence offices all across China and Hong Kong, needed to move documents around. And at that time, they didn't have a fully fledged intelligence service. So by virtue of being the wife of a naval officer, she was considered sort of cleared. She was considered background checked. And I think this is why she moved things around. And if you look at how she manages to get tickets on trains and boats, how she manages to get into the best hotels at a time when no one could find accommodation anywhere because of all the chaos in China, someone is obviously prepping the ground for her.
And if so, and people are wondering, well, why are the Americans getting all upset about what's happening in China? Of course, they've got the Philippines. They've taken over the Philippines. They've, you know, again, 40 years previous to that, or 30 years previous to that. So they have a massive presence in there, even in the 20s, which will obviously lead to what happens in, you know, with MacArthur or whatever in the 30s. So it is in their hugely in their interest to keep tabs on what's happening on China, but B, obviously with Japan's imperialistic sort of ambitions.
Yeah, well, America is looking to make a lot of money in China. It's a big trading power there. But to be fair to the Americans, they were at this time doing something that the Europeans weren't. The Europeans were Britain, France, Japan as well, were trying to grab little bits of territory, increase their territory. The Americans had this idea that they weren't really an imperial power, although, of course, as you've pointed out, in the Philippines and so on, they were. But what they're trying to do is broker peace talks between Sun Yat-sen and the Republican government in the South, which has been in power since 1911, and the various warlords. And funnily enough, they're trying to do this in late 1924 in Tianjin, the port in northern China that Wallis Simpson sails into, claiming in her memoirs much, much later, oh, I just thought I'd go on a shopping trip. I mean, this is like someone deciding, I'll go for a weekend break shopping trip in, Ukraine.
Is this a Salisbury Cathedral spire thing? Is it one of these jobs?
It's completely mad. But what the Americans are trying to do is broker a peace deal between the northern warlords of China and Sun Yat-sen to try and form one government, to stop China exploding into, you know, if it had exploded, we could be looking at not China as one big country, but something more akin to Central Asia, you know, and various little stans all over the place, little fiefdoms, some successful, some not. And what the Americans tried to do was bring these two people together, but it was impossible. The warlords just like fighting with each other. Tianjin was full of typhoid and cholera, and Sun Yat-sen sadly was dying of liver cancer at the time and wasn't really able to muster his full political energies. You know, Wallis Simpson is moving around with the people that are trying to broker these peace deals in Tianjin, in Beijing, in Shanghai. And I think that's a really different story to just, she's just flouncing around in and out of the race club, in and out of cabarets and nightclubs, you know, which is the sort of traditional story of her time in China.
And it gives her, I suppose you can say, gives her this, you know, this inner confidence. She's come from one abusive marriage where she's been, you know, been beaten up by a drunken husband. And then she goes and, if you like, discovers herself here. I mean, she becomes, and not only that, but during this period of time, you mentioned that China is in vogue with the jazz age and whatever, but she comes back with this, when she does leave China, she comes back with this signature style that, you know, which many American women of the time just wouldn't have got. And so she makes an impact when she comes back to America or to Europe.
Yes, I mean, she has, she falls in love with the Chinese aesthetic immediately, which is popular in Europe, but she absolutely has the original. She's in Beijing and she can have tailors very cheaply make things for her. And if you look at her all through her life, she always wore the kind of qipao, qiong sam type dresses, which admittedly being very, being tall and thin suited her very well. But she would have Chinese style knotwork on those. Of course, one thing she developed in Beijing was a love of jade, and she would go through the markets buying and then reselling jade, of course. That stayed with her all her life, although, of course, a lot later, you know, she bought her jade at Cartier rather than a market. But, yeah, that and the chignon hairstyle, you know, her very trademark sort of hairstyle, which is based on sort of Manchu women's hairstyles from the Qing dynasty. Cecil Beaton said it was so black and shiny, if a fly landed on it, it would just slip off. And, of course, her and the Duke of Windsor in exile always had Chinese pug dogs as well. So she loved that. She loved that style. And you can actually trace, and I do in the book, you know, various things that she bought in markets in Beijing, Chinese screens, little ivory elephants, lacquerware boxes that followed her back to America. Then, of course, when she married Ernest Simpson and moved to London, and then when she became the Duchess of Windsor and lived in the Villa Windsor in the Bois de Boulogne in Paris. These things followed her all through her life. So it was a time when she mixed in a cosmopolitan international society, diplomats, business people, rich people, very educated people as well, sinologists. And so when she later is in London and she walks into the party where she meets the Prince of Wales, she's not this Navy officer's wife from boring Baltimore. She is this international woman who has moved in circles. She knows how to talk. She knows how to converse. She knows how to, you know, push herself forward. She's learned to be independent and interesting. And I think that that's, again, something that's rather sort of glossed over with her. She's always seen as a sort of a man catcher or sort of very determined like that. But I think she was someone who was able to walk into a room, light it up, had some pretty good anecdotes from her time in China, had a pretty interesting life. And I think the Prince of Wales, you know, coming from actually a much more reserved and insular circle than Wallace was used to, found that fascinating.
Yeah, because it would, you know, she lights up a room and he's, you know, believes his destiny is all planned out before him. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's a decision for the woman he loves, etc. He puts himself, which he is, you know, in a society where service and knowing your place is everything. This is why we have this tremendous backlash in the way that, you know, I remember my grandmother would literally spit on the ground when her name was mentioned, kind of thing. So this comment she makes about her lotus year, I mean, she's referring to classical imagery, but of course it gets picked up, doesn't it, by Whispering Campaign, and that's where this whole sort of Wallace Simpson as this louche sort of drug taking Mata Hari comes from, basically.
Yeah, and it's all invented, but interestingly, when the intelligence services cooked it up, they used stories that were all true about other people. But of course, it's 12 or 13 years after the events. And when these things are whispered around, nobody can go and kind of check the story on Google or just call up the old newspaper articles or anything like that. They're just like, oh, yeah, wasn't there an American woman in Beijing who had affairs with lots of other people? You know, wasn't there someone who was broke and ended up working for an opium ring? Wasn't there someone who, you know, to make some money, did some sort of saucy pictures for a rich man? All of these stories are true, and I have all of those stories in the book. They're just not true about Wallace.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. Did this make you reappraise? Because obviously you've got background on the way the Chinese, the Chinese look at this one. Does it sort of make you reappraise the sort of the forlorn figures of Wallace and her husband as they sort of try and get a base? You know, they try and get a base and they try and get a lifestyle, and then they make some questionable decisions. I mean, obviously, there's going to visit Nazi Germany, going to the Mercedes factory, etc., and then there's Portugal and various other bits and pieces they do when they're in exile.
Oh, definitely, and you know, they definitely made some questionable decisions later. They were in a uniquely odd situation in terms of their lives. But I mean, all I would argue with that is, coming at it personally as not someone who, as you know, is a feels particularly one way or the other on the royal family, I kind of think to myself, look, you know, I'm not the person I was at 40. And when I was 40, I wasn't the person I was at 30. And when I was 30, I wasn't the person I was at 20. And I feel like, you know, we need to see what Wallace Simpson may have become, perhaps this more hardened figure later after the years in exile. During the war years, they may have made some silly mistakes. But this is a 28, 29-year-old Wallace coming out of a bad, abusive marriage and flinging herself really bravely into somewhere that's full of chaos. Of course, as a white woman traveling around in China at that time, she has a certain protective bubble, and she's aware that she lives in that bubble. But she is also seeing the chaos around her as well. And I think, you know, when we look at that 28, 29-year-old Wallis Simpson, you know, I found myself to have a lot of sympathy for her and found her to be quite an interesting, attractive person. And I wish that in all the interviews she did later, there'd been someone like me who could say, look, let's not talk about the abdication and the marriage and everything. I want to go back and ask you about China, which she writes about in just a few pages, but very tenderly in her memoir, which was written in the 1950s. And finally, during the abdication, she fled to France, where she stayed with people she'd met in China, actually. But she wrote a letter to the king saying, look, don't do this, right? I'm not worth a throne and an empire. No woman is, right? You don't need to marry me. I will just disappear. I will just go to, I don't know, I will just go to China. So China obviously lived with her. It remained this place that she had been happy, this place that she had enjoyed her time in. As she said, her lotus year, Homer's shipwrecked sailors who discover that they actually like it on the island. It's soporific. They almost never want to go home and resume their lives. They don't want to escape the desert island. And that, I think, stuck with her throughout her life.
Yeah, but then again, you see, the China that she imagines isn't there anymore, because you get Nanking, you get the Japanese invasion, and then you've got what happens in the Second World War with, you know, the Americans saying they're going to help support, you know, the nationalists, and the, you know, because China splits again. And then the name of the Chinese leader during the Second World War.
Chiang Kai-shek.
Thank you very much. And then, of course, we get the Cultural Revolution in 48. So that China is gone forever. Also, she would think.
Oh, well, yes, that's absolutely true. And she sees almost the very end of it. And of course, by the time we get to the abdication in 1936, 1937, that really is the end of that old China, because Japan invades China in 1937. That's really the start of the Second World War. So, yes, but in her mind, you know, it's like when we think of holidays we had as kids, when we think of places we were, where we were very happy, places where we had a nice, you know, perhaps a holiday fling. We had a bit of money in our pocket and we didn't really have any cares in the world. We weren't worried about careers or pension pots or anything like that. You know, that this China is her moment like that.
The book is called Her Lotus Year, China, the Roaring Twenties and the Making of Wallis Simpson. It's by Paul French, who is speaking to you today. Paul, if people want to find you online, I know you're active on social media. Can people find you on the web?
I'm very easy to find. I do a lot of blogging and posting old photos and bits and pieces about China for anyone that's interested at ChinaRhymingOneWord.com. And you can find me there, and that's where I am on social media as well.
ChinaRhyming.com. You can also order the book via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called Her Lotus Year. It's written by Paul French. Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
This has been a great chat. Thanks.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices, with beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.
Right. salutes those who've served. Veterans Ride Free, Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.